to want to analyze the experience and come to grips with it, which is quite different from, say, right after the war ended.
That's true, and that's why we didn't talk about
it. You mentioned that the funding came from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Where did they... What is the source of their money? Individual Americans?
No. Well, ultimately, it's a federally funded agency, so it comes from taxpayers' dollars.
But it came from the federal government, the money then, didn't
yes.
for your movie then.
Yes.
What did the corporations and others that turned you down? What were their excuses they give you?
I can't honestly say that I ever got what I would consider an excuse. They just. A couple of them looked at it very seriously. I know in at least the case of two major corporations, the people who normally make decisions about funding public television programs wanted to fund it. When it was referred to the boards of those companies, all we ever heard was that the answer was no. We don't know why, really.
Did you ever ask organized labor to help you?
I am not... I think the answer is no. I was not always involved in every development effort that was made. The station, WGBH, has a whole department that tries to do that. But I'm not aware that they ever approached organized labor.
At one point you said some film was staged by East Germans. Were any other... film staged, or were they all authentic?
We're never sure, frankly, about any of the film from the North Vietnamese sources. Where you see it, it is as it was identified by them when we did the archive research. That is to say, they had film that they said was shot at the Yed Drang Valley, and that's the film that you see in that intercut with our film, the American film, in that sequence. But there. Throughout Eastern Europe and in much of the rest of the world, the tradition of documentary is not the same as ours. They don't think of it as cheating as we do to restage something. So, for example, most famous film from the Viet Minh side in the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the decisive battle of the First Indochina War. Was actually shot by a Soviet documentary director named Roman Carman a few days after the battle was over, when all the troops were still there. They had unexpended ammunition, and they actually staged attacks and running up the trenches and all of that sort of thing. And at this point, it's very difficult to know which film of that battle he shot and which film was shot 3 days before or in the months before when the battle was going on. And what we had to do with that in that film was just to say so in the commentary. That it's all in the right place and it's the right people, but some of it may have been recreated.
Was the scene of the apparent massacre by American troops, was that from Army Archives?
Yes. Yes, sir.
You presented this in a very excellent manner. It's an evolutionary way in the way you presented it. And the way that it was so sneaky and came so gradually, it leaves me with an uneasy feeling that it could happen again, possibly, as the other gentleman mentioned a while ago. Since this is all over and you've made the other movies and so forth too, in your own view, do you feel like we learned enough that maybe we're smart enough to avoid this situation in the future? What's your overall gut feeling on this question?
I'm not too sure that as I say, it's retrospective views are so much clearer. So much easier to form distinctly. I'm worried about that. I think it's very easy to. There are a lot of things that are expressed in that film that were either not known at all or were not clearly known at the time. For example, the Tonkin Gulf affair, the doubts about the. Whether or not the second incident occurred were were closely held. There was some expressed suspicion, but I don't think that any official source for some time revealed the fact that there were very, very considerable doubts quite close to the event itself. And it's just in the nature of things that that governments tend to have secrets. So I'm not sure what we've learned yet.
What do you see in parallels? I see some haunting parallels in terms of Johnson proposing a huge economic project, and Reagan had proposed a huge economic project for an area that had been totally neglected by the United States. Such parallels really do strike you if you live these events in a visceral way. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments on parallels here between Central America now and Vietnam then?
Well, I probably have some, but I'm not a political analyst. My sense of what they are would be about as good as valuable as yours. I'm really just a filmmaker.
There is a certain irony, and it may be a little too simplistic to put it this way, but there is a certain irony at work here that here, as you say, in a sense, the Vietnam War is coming out of the closet. You referred to the veterans, but I think it's also true of the war itself and its impact on the United States. And that war, in a sense, subsumed Johnson's great society in some ways. It caused him serious problems, and I think that was suggested in your film. And now, as the Vietnam War is coming back to be dealt with by Americans, the Reagan administration is in many ways dismantling the last vestiges of the Great Society. And, you know, I'm not a political analyst either, and I don't know what that means, but it's at least interesting to note. And I think there are certain things going on in Central America, however nascent, however tiny, however small, that suggests that this sort of thing can happen again. There has been, especially at the beginning of this year, and I think there will be in the near future, gathering evidence about secret CIA funding of counter-revolutionaries to destabilize the Nicaraguan government. They are, in a sense, very modest operations. They don't involve American troops. But they do involve American dollars. And Honduras is just, they're all over the place. In Honduras, you've got counter-revolutionaries. There's no doubt that there's American money involved in that operation. And I think that more and more will be coming out about this. And it's all, at this point, it's largely speculative, but there clearly is some sort of program, an orchestrated program, going on in Central America. And whether, I think it's a little simplistic, a little melodramatic to say that we have another Vietnam, but we certainly have at least the possibility of a seed being planted, and I think that's what you're worried about.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment related to these last two comments and ask you a question.
I came up here as a reporter, but also with some perspectives as a World War II veteran and father of some sons who were old enough to have served in Vietnam. So I've got a lot of perspectives. But I came up here thinking about or wondering about what might evolve out of this symposium, since it dealt with the healing the nightmare of Vietnam. And I don't say this particularly critically, because I think it's almost inevitable, but I do see the makings of trying to draw comparisons
between Vietnam and what's happening in the world today, and letting these discussions become real debates on current issues. And maybe that's inevitable in a symposium of this nature. But I just wonder, I'm going to get my question here, Harry. Since your objective is healing the nightmare of Vietnam, whether you might have any response, perhaps in the way of closing, if people are ready to close, about your hopes and how you view what course these discussions should take.
Well,
I'm not ready to Harry Wilmer over here.
I do have a comment on historical parallels, and it is drawing them is a risky temptation. It's always a great temptation, but I think it seems to me that there are risks involved. There's at least one school of thought that that too automatic and wide sweeping a use of the Munich parallel was a contributing factor to certain mistakes in analysis in Indochina. That is to say that the automatic assumption was that if you define a certain act as aggression, it must be met, and the reason it must be met is because we didn't do it at Munich, and therefore we had World War II. Now, you know, one can debate whether or not that's right, but there, as I say, there are historians who would argue that it was not always used wisely in looking at events since World War II. And I think there is a similar risk in drawing analogies from Vietnam without thinking about all of the variables, because there can be certainly many, many variables.
Maybe we can take one more question. One more question?
One more question?
Can I make a comment as the only one, I guess, who've ever done, who lived through this period? One thing these are less important than the two points I made. One is that if you go back to the American press, including the press you flashed on the screen with a screaming headline of war conscription and so on, there was no ambiguity in the country about the July decision of the president. This was a major event. There were full consultations with the Congress. It was Mr. Rusk, as he indicated, and Tommy Thompson, our ambassador to Moscow, who really decided for the combined leadership of the President and the Congress that there'd be no new resolution because they both feared that it might activate some secret agreement. But the notion, which was more in your handout than it was in the film, but there's a little bit in the talk, that this snuck up on folks is quite wrong factually, as any going back to the press will reveal. And it was supported overwhelmingly by the American people at the time and the Congress. I'm talking about July 65. Mm-hmm. The other is the rather casual comment on the South Vietnamese and their government. You were correctly portraying this series of coups. And I trust in other films you'll get into the two key period and the elections, which were supervised by American governors, rabbis, priests, labor leaders, were scrupulously done, and the evolution from 65 down to 73 was that of a post-colonial country with all the miseries, which moved forward rather remarkably if you look at the education figures, land reform figures, and the picture that this was a country which remained in the state that you projected it to dramatize the 11 governments in whatever months it was is a quite false picture. And these folks went on, and they beat the North Vietnamese in 1972 without one U.S. soldier on the ground. And they earned that truce and peace in 73. But so that's an analogy. We don't have your films for 65 forward. But I didn't want to leave that observation and generalization about the evolution of this little post-colonial country where it was.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that is very striking, just in general, and it continues to be true throughout, at least the best analysis that we have been able to make of all of the public opinion polling and studies done throughout this entire period, is that almost any time the president did any decisive thing, there was a surge upward in support, and that decisive thing could be a de-escalatory move or an escalatory move, and it really didn't matter. The whole the secret to getting the support, it seems, was to be decisive. And, of course, that I think was, again, one of the things that happened at the Tet Offensive that was that hurt the support of the administration was the fact that for a time Johnson appeared to be doing nothing. It was not, he did not make a strong public response, and he lost support for that reason. At least that's how we read the data. Okay, I think I'll...
Can I just add something to what Professor Rothstein said as somebody who was covering the story for the press?
Oh, hello, Mr. Jeff.
At the time. It's true what Walt says, that there was no great public outcry in the press. The main reason there wasn't was that the president was campaigning on a very simple theme. He said the message three or four times that American boys were not going to be asked to go fight a war that Asian boys ought to fight. That was his line. Those were his words. There was every reason for complacency. There was, as you say, no great argument over the facts of Tonkin, which was too bad. And as somebody said in the film, that presidents have a habit of making decisions without waiting to see what the facts are. But if I had one minor complaint with your production, I wish instead of Wayne Morris, you had put the serious senators who objected to the Tonkin resolution in your program. There were four. Gaylord Nelson actually introduced an amendment and asked the Fulbright to accept it, which would have dealt specifically with the issue of American troops. And it was supported by Senator Brewster of Maryland and Morton and Cooper of Kentucky. And there was a very vigorous debate. All Morris and Greening did was vote against it. There was a real debate in the Senate. And Fulbright stopped the debate with two arguments. One was that the president was in a hurry and he didn't want to go to conference with the House with an amendment. But the second one was that if he thought for a moment that the administration had that kind of idea in mind, he would not be floor managing the bill. I think that's an important part of the history.
I agree.
I want to thank you, Richard, for that, bringing that film here. And I think there's an emotional experience seeing such a film that conveys the, in retrospect, the utter frustration of how this thing evolved. And there's something in the visual image of bringing this back to us so that we can examine it. That's what I hope we do, that we look at this thing in a new perspective. It's a significant fact that the government made these films accessible to this documentary. Up until this war, it was a matter of state secrets, not only in England but in the United States. The Japanese Hiroshima films were kept secret for 20 years before they were released. So that we now have a chance to examine a visual image, the real people saying this in such a an impressive way. I think that I was wrong in making a kind of biting comment on whether or not the last issue of this film series is produced or not. I don't think it matters. I think that what has been done, what is being done, and how you are here to look at what is being done and said, and what the men said, it's not we cannot heal a nightmare unless we can wake up, you see? And what we do, I don't want to limit anybody's debate or comments, but it's a matter of waking up from a nightmare, and we have to know how we're going to live out our lives now. And we're going to know a great deal more about it tomorrow. And I thank you again, and I thank you all for your attention. Good evening.
That concludes this session. Thank you.